This is August 8th. Because of the sheer passage of time, most people have forgotten August 8th, 1978, when police in Philadelphia unleashed a blitzkrieg against members of the MOVE organization. There, police fired hundreds of rounds into the house, fired tons of water, and after people were flushed from the house, several were beaten on the street. The cops who beat one man, Delbert Africa, for example, were ordered acquitted by a local judge despite videotape. When MOVE members went to trial, eight men and women were railroaded on dubious murder charges for killing a cop who almost certainly was the subject of so-called friendly fire. The city of Philadelphia made sure that this question couldn't be resolved by literally tearing down MOVE's house, allegedly an active crime scene, by nightfall. But none of this mattered, for there was a railroad in process, and eight MOVE people were sent to state gulags for 30 to 100 years. Behind the attack on MOVE was certainly their radical lifestyle in opposition to state power, but there was also the dynamic of powerful real estate interests, which wanted to expand their holdings to create a greater university city. For MOVE, August 8th isn't 30 years ago. It's yesterday. It's that close. They need your support to end this injustice. For more information, contact the MOVE organization on the web at www.onamove.com. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Good morning, and welcome to Wanda's Picks, the Black Arts and Culture Program of the African Sisters Media Network, and that was Mumia Abu-Jamal. And today, at the end of the show, our last interview is with Michael Africa, who was born April 8, 1978, actually born in prison. His mother had him, Debbie Africa, and his father, Michael Africa Sr. They were split up, of course, but Debbie had him in the cell, and the prison didn't even know that there had been a child born until the MOVE 9 at that time went to court, and Janine Africa, one of the MOVE 9, announced to the court that he had been born. And so it's an amazing story, 34 years behind bars, these men and women, and Michael Africa, the only free MOVE member from that experience. And we are joined in the studio by Fiverr Alchemist, April Martin Chartrand. And we mentioned last week, and we weren't kidding, that we were going to continue our lovely conversation. Good morning, April. How are you?
Hi, good morning, Wanda. Enjoy this beautiful sunny day.
Isn't it beautiful? It's like, whoa, we're having summer finally. What is this?
Yeah, like next week it will be foggy again, you know?
I hope not. Yeah, it's just fantastic. Yeah, and I sent you a lot of questions, and you sent me back a response. And, you know, why don't we talk for a minute about the film that you turned me on to that I went to see yesterday that is just simply fantastic, Beast of the Southern Wild by Bennett Zetlin. First time, this is his first feature film, and it's set in the southern part of Louisiana golf coast called The Bathtub, and it stars these just really remarkable adult and child protagonists, two first-time actors, and it just, oh my goodness, the story is just simply wonderful. And the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina is coming up August 29th, and so I'm always really sort of like interested in stories, you know, Louisiana stories, Gulf region stories, and this one here is such a different type of story. It sort of looks at life as a part of a continuum of a bigger organism, and our part and our place as human beings in that whole system. So anyway, just some thoughts about the film Beast of the Southern Wild.
You know, that film was incredibly beautiful. It actually, there was a playwright, as I mentioned last week, Imani Harrington, and her her play was about the Katrina, and she was using allegory and symbolism to tell a story about the Middle Passage. The Katrina flooding was a symbol for the Middle Passage, and the people who were not as, I guess, well off as the people in the north, all the South Ward, people always knew it was going to be under sea level. So these same people in the beast of the Southern Wilds were in that same predicament. However, there was a combination of African-American and other white people that came together in a way that was I've never seen before in a film. Mm-hmm. It was this kind of sense of rooting, a sense of earthing, and it was at a guttural, very primal level. I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that people were connected, like my ancestors, the Native Americans, to the ground, to the earth, and used the earth as a way to sustain themselves because they had no money. And their ingenuity, their creativity was amazing. However, Hush Puppy's daddy was pretty much gone in the head. And, you know, there's a lot of drinking, a lot of yelling, and he's in the hospital sick. However, she was incredibly strong. Her facial features, they went right through my heart. And as someone who was influenced by, you know, the whole thing of Katrina and two of my pieces of the Middle Passage, that play really just got to my heart. I left out of there just kind of, I can't get Hush Puppy out of my mind.
Yeah, because when my mother told me about, I was actually on my way over to San Francisco to the Embarcadero Cinema to see it yesterday afternoon, and I ran to a colleague of mine, and we were talking, and I couldn't remember the name of the film because it's a mouthful, it's a real mouthful, but I remember the character Hush Puppy because my mother told me about it. My mother's in Southern California; she always keeps me abreast of what's going on, you know, in our community, particularly the arts. And she said, oh, did you know about this film? And I told her no. And she said, oh, there's this character named Hush Puppy. And she said, she didn't like the name Hush Puppy because she said where that name comes from, you know, it's like a cornbread that's made like a pancake, and you usually have it with fish and things like that. And she said what they would do is they would throw them to, you know, to the puppies to hush them up. And so it's like, oh, okay, didn't know that history.
I used to eat those when I was a kid.
Right. Yeah, I don't know if I ever made any, but I certainly ate them because I'm a Louisiana person. Yeah, but I just, wow. The film reminded me, actually, of Daughters of the Dust. Julie Dash's,
it has that same mystical vibe.
And that energy, like the real slow moving, just, you know, not rushing, just things are unfolding as they unfold naturally. And you think, wow, how many Katrina stories have you seen like this where, you know, you're not being bombarded with a lot of imagery all at once? It's unfolding at a more leisurely pace, not that anything is sort of undermined because of the pacing, but you're allowed to sort of be in it a little bit longer than you would have been be in it if you try to put too much into the frame at once. So that's one thing. You could actually feel the mounting tension and what these folks had to deal with, you know, once the hurricane happened. And yeah, it's just, I highly recommend. I'm going to try to get the director, you know, some of the actors on my radio show on the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. I'm looking to do that. I hope it happens. But April, you are an author and an illustrator, you mentioned in your bio that you present fiber alchemy as a way to express your artistic creation. Your work ranges from chemical textile painting and sculptural sewing, wall relief, which incorporates found object assemblage, digital art graphics, and poetic expressions. And last week we were talking about your treasured art boxes, looking at the legacy of our people of African descent, in the tobacco growing in the Western Hemisphere, which made a lot of nations rich, and sort of using tobacco as a metaphor for the Middle Passage and what happened to African people, you know, once they left home. And I wanted to talk some more, and you mentioned your family. I wanted you to talk a little bit more about art and ancestry and its link to mental health and personal prosperity, and, you know, sort of looking at what you said already about the protagonist in this film. His name is Wink, and you think about Sekou Sundiata, and he's got a poem where he talks about blink and how so much can change when you close your eyes. Like, just for a second, you close your eyes and the whole world can be different, you know? So I was wondering if you could talk about art and ancestry and this link to mental health and personal prosperity that you explore in your work in its variety of genres and perspectives.
Well, for me, in terms of my personal background and my ancestry, because my ancestry was rooted in the South, so many of my ancestors had to improvise, had very little, you know, to use to create art in a world of serious undermining of their spirit. So a lot of the people in my family had to use juju and a lot of root healing as a creative force. And some of my ancestors, Charity Ann Parker, who was the senior Mr. Parker's son's concubine, as well as the mother of his 18 children, her form of creativity, again, as I said, was food healing of the family. She was a cook along with the healing woman, and she had to basically keep her family as well as their family healthy through root gathering, and plus she was Native American, so she had that bend to it. So for me, the prosperous part is about keeping a legacy alive under any circumstance and creating that sense of survival and being creative enough to weather the storm, so to speak, in dire situations. So that informs me. Additionally, through my travels throughout South America, Mexico, the Virgin Islands of the Caribbean, and throughout the United States and Hawaii, all of those expeditions and explorations, not as a tourist per se, but a person that really wants to look at the global landscape. All of that, at the moment when I went, like in 92, I was in Brazil, I was impacted by the plethora of African people, because that story had not been told. And the richness of Bahia, which is the biggest slaveholding area in the Americas, I don't think people understand that the United States was not the biggest area for African slaves. Bahia was, and also, what else? Oh, yeah, Bahia was, and also, I'm getting my mind screwed up here, and all of the Caribbean were more of the larger shareholders of people of color. However, their stories, African slaves rather, their stories had not been told. When I was in Brazil, I would talk to people that were native Brazilians, and they had no idea about their history. They had no idea about what it really was because the schools don't teach it. Their presence is undervalued, and his history is told by the captors, which are the Portuguese. So in terms of richness, it's all there. You could see it during Carnival. You see how people, you know, survive. So that informs how art is made, by sheer survival and coming up with whatever it takes to make something other than yourself happen.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So in light of that, how has your travel in the African diaspora helped you to reconstruct your person, personhood as an individual and as a person who is a member of this fragmented or dispersed community, you know, this Pan-African community, how has travel and how has your art, you've already started talking about, you know, these stories that you're telling with your work, you know, as a writer as well as, you know, a visual artist, how has art helped you to heal this rift that we've inherited.
Right. In terms of my background, which is Native American, I hold those traditions to be true for myself, mm-hmm. and also having Irish ancestry as well as African American ancestry. I don't totally believe in the one drop rule because that's all about slavery and holdings. I really want to embrace everything that I know to be true in my system. Mm-hmm. So in terms of my connection, I kind of take things a little bit more holistically and include everything to formulate who I actually am. Because when I was a kid, people always say that, you know, are you sure you're not Native American because you're always looking at plants, you're always doing different things, and you're always having these little ceremonies for yourself. And for me, when I got older, I didn't understand a lot of this. But as I traveled, as I said, I wasn't really aware of what was really going down because I hadn't taken psychology, I hadn't taken sociology, and I didn't have a grasp of the various entities that made the global connection through these corporations happen through the triangular trade with rum and tobacco and various other, like diamond mining. I didn't quite get what that really meant because the way it's taught here, it's played down as if it's a manifest destiny. As a result, my sense of self had been kind of squashed. My sense of importance in this life was minimized, not only as a woman, but also a woman of dark skin color. And there was always a thing where you have to be lighter skin to get it together, so to speak, and that way you can get farther along. But I soon learned that was also a fallacy. So as I'm traveling, I begin to look at things, and later on, like maybe 10 years later, I start looking at all these things that affected me, how naive I was in my understanding of what was happening when I was there, and I started researching and looking at the real history underneath all the stuff that we've been told. And so that part of my creativity, like the curiosity of taking a moment to be silent and learn to swim with uncertainty and being silent through meditation, because I'm a practicing Buddhist, and being quiet with your mind, you know, being silent for weeks at a time and not saying a word. All this inspired poetry. It inspired dreams. It inspired a body of work that I didn't know where it was coming from. So my ancestry, my travels in connection back to my ancestry, and also not only ancestry, it's about global connections because I totally believe there are no such things as races. Somebody's made that stuff up because based on DNA, we're all basically, you know, we're human, you know, from the human race, and that's one. So there's various connections. You know, I go to different places. I see people eating some of the same food. Some of the same rituals are there. So we're definitely connected. Mm-hmm. That's how I'm informed by my art. I don't want to be looked at as like a black artist or, you know, a mixed race artist, whatever those words mean. I am an artist that's taking from the global consciousness. We call it the collective consciousness. It's more of a Jungian way of looking at things. Mm-hmm. And we're all absorbed into this big melting pot. Whether we want to connect with it, that's another thing. Whether we choose to be in our little boxes and our separatism, that's another thing. But when you're open, like I am, to see the bigger picture, it can be incredibly beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell me about some of these stories that you're telling, just looking at your bio. And what you do on, you have in San Francisco, July 1st is April Martin Chartrand Day. So, what happened on your birthday, your special day in San Francisco? What do they do July 1st, 2012?
Yeah, that wasn't really my birthday. It was the day.
Your day, you know, your proclamation day, not your birthday.
Right, yeah, the proclamation day, that was when Willie Brown was in office.
Mm-hmm.
I had done a lot of work in the community with domestic violence through the Commission on the Status on Women. I had won, Isabel Stirner Award. Right when I began, I think it was in 95 or so, I had been on a panel of women who organized domestic violence awareness in the workplace. It was a city and county organized effort to get doctors and caregivers to ask these various questions. When a person comes in for treatment, have you ever been hurt? Have you ever been yelled at? Have you ever been demeaned? Before this, that wasn't being asked in the hospitals or the clinics. So I was on that team of women. I was an intern with City and County at the time, and that's kind of where all this came from, because I had won all these awards because of my dogged work and healing from my own issues. I ended up being on Michael Krasny's show, and I was a guest along with various people from the Commission on the Status on Women, and there were some speakers from the government that were on the show. This is right after Nicole Brown Simpson was killed. So I was on that show, and I ended up being on TV later, on KTVU, I believe, like a week later, and I was one of the only survivors who showed up to speak in front of City Hall, ended up on TV on national news at 10 o'clock. And I'm thinking, what am I doing? I could get myself killed here. So, you know, the more you're open, your abuser knows where you are, and they can get upset, even though you don't mention their name, the fact that their secret is out. So that's where that day came from. People started recognizing, noticing, and said, well, this person needs to be recognized because she's come from hell and high water, so, and she's done all this work around giving back. So that's how that happened.
Okay. So did anything happen on your day? I mean, I know a lot of times municipalities, they give these, you know, persons these proclamations, but the general public doesn't remember like this.
Yeah, they didn't know, because basically they gave it to me. I had to arrange to go take a picture with Willie Brown, and that was an effort. And so I took up on myself to do that, but that was basically it. You know, I have a picture of me and him all dressed up and looking kind of cute, but that was basically it. And I just told a bunch of people and let my friends and family people know, and I had really no celebration because I don't really have family here. So there was nothing big. It was just, you know, something that I did. I was proud of it, but it was nothing I wanted to brag or boast about. You know, it was just my part in this universe, and I was doing my thing.
Yeah, because I was just thinking that, you know, considering it was looking at violence against women, it would have been really great to do something to bring people's attention to the fact that this is still happening.
But we already did that. We were on TV during October, and we had Domestic Violence Awareness Month.
No. I'm talking about July 1st. I mean, you know, on your day, you know, it would have been nice. You know, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, so I'm sure something's going to happen in October a couple of months from now. And I was just thinking, you know, when I just read it, it's like, oh, that would have, you know, considering, you know, when you told me the history of the day, you know, and what precipitated, I mean, among all of your work, what precipitated that, I was thinking that would have been great. I was also looking at some of your other work around in 2002. You were a featured artist on KRON-TV News Health Segment Art, AIDS, and African Americans for your Condom Card Project.
Yeah,
tell us about that.
Well, I have a lot of friends who have passed. It especially for me was really painful and hurtful during the early 80s. That's when they didn't have all the cocktails ready, and the government and the CDC, well, the CDC was held hostage by the various government entities to develop something. So a lot of my friends who are artists, dancers, choreographers, writers, passed away, and seeing them pass away in that horrible state was hard to take. So several of my friends, you know, a month or so before were going to pass, I was there holding their hand, seeing just skin and bone, that type of thing. It was hard, very hard. And as a result, I wrote poetry about one of my friends who passed. I ended up reading it at the Women's Craft Fair. We had a stage. So I read the poem about him. That was my only way of healing, because I just could not heal. I was going through my own drama. So I wrote the poem in like 10 minutes, and I read it, and I had people coming up to me at the Women's Craft Fair crying and saying, you really must be brave, because I could never do that. I go, well, you love somebody and you care for someone. They're giving you so much. You have to give back in some kind of way, and this is my way of doing it. So as a result, I started making these condom cards. I would get condoms from several companies. They would give them to me free, and I started using them on these handmade cards I would make, and then actually sell them or give them away to various organizations, because I gave a bunch of them to APEB, AIDS Project East Bay, and they gave them out for, you know, various events. And also I gave back to the company who actually had me, who gave me the free condoms. They wanted to give them to their reps. So I asked KRON to do a series on my condom cards, because I had them in the store in the Castro. As a result, the gentleman who interviewed me decided to talk to the people at APEB, AIDS Project East Bay, and also Idris and Rogessa Jones were doing a piece around this topic at the time. So they had a collage of all of us in this segment, on the health segment on KRON. So I had contacted Pam Moore and sent her a card, and that's how it got this whole thing started. She gave it to her health person. I called and talked to Pam, said, you know, what do you think? And the people were thinking, oh, she's just self-promoting. And she goes, no, 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 you don't understand. She's doing something for the community. This is not about her. That's the take they were thinking. I'm being selfish. I want to get free promotion. I don't know. So Pam got it, and she put the word in for me. So that's how that project started, and that's how I was able to be on TV and talk about this issue in our community.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's really wonderful, because, you know, 10 years later, you know, that was in 2012, on a, what was the station, Frontline World, there was a film last month, Endgame, AIDS in the Black Community. I mean, the Black community is still being confronted with new cases in 2012, and the epidemic is still a pandemic in Alameda County. I don't know what it looks like in San Francisco, but it's, you know, certainly, you know, using art as a prevention education tool is certainly wonderful. Yeah. And then you also mentioned, because we were looking at, you know, art for social change, with art as a way to document history. And in this case, you know, the work that you've done around Allensworth. And I was wondering if you could talk about, in our closing moments, Africa Mono series. Gosh, I don't know how.
Series? Yeah.
Yeah, what is that? Yeah, it sounded like, wow, I missed that too.
Yeah, well, that was long time ago. I had been reading a book called African Presence in Early Asia. I'd always been interested in kind of the Asian-African connection, because I know friends who have Asian ancestry, but it's not talked about, and also the Asian African history is not talked about in various parts of Asia. But I started doing research initially for a woman who's passed, who had a braiding company, and I start showing her different braiding styles from all over Asia. There's a Buddhist braiding style called the 108 braids, which is based on 108 ringings of the bell. And so they wear their hair in braids. So I started getting connected. I go, what is this connection about? And I started looking at the colossal heads in Mexico, how a lot of the backs of their heads are shaved off because they don't want to see that they actually have braids, because they would connect the facial features with the braids and go, oh, Africa. But in any event, the Africa Mono series came out of me understanding that connection. And I started making these paper kimonos and naming them after famous people all over the world, including Asia, Africa, and the United States. So I had them on display at the City Hall, which was a great show. I had them on display at City College. I had my own show. I sold several of them, one's in a corporation, Meyer Stevens Corporation or something. But I really wanted people to cultivate a knowingness about how we are so integrated. So how could Africans not have migrated prior to Christ throughout the Upper Asia, various parts of India? Because when you look at folks in the Philippines and the various parts of, you know, Australia, we're seeing an African connection there, you know? And everywhere I go, I see it. So these pieces were a part of my coming together with that part of our history. And I contacted KTVU, Bay Area People at the time, and there was Alani Chow, I believe, she's of Asian descent, she was interested. They had no idea about that history. A lot of their interns were of Asian ancestry or ethnicity. They had no idea. So I ended up talking about that connection. So that had brought a new way of looking at history and a new way of seeing themselves. Not that it's going to make a lot of difference for some people because they're so steeped in their way of thinking, but at least someone may have been enlightened by the new information.
Wow. Wow. That is, it's just amazing the way, you know, sort of history informs quite a bit of your art. And it's just really, really something. And did your exhibit travel to Allensworth Historic State Park? Because it says that it was featured the Allensworth State.
I was featured on Bay Area Backroads with Doug McConnell. Mm-hmm. And before he came on as a host, they had did a feature on Allensworth prior to that because they had their biennial or their annual event or something.
Okay.
And I had, after I went to a 14-day silent meditation retreat in Joshua Tree, I came back and drove myself by myself on this lonely highway with no cell phone because there was no cell phones back then, a rickety Honda Civic, and I went to Allensworth by myself. As people might know, it's a historic state park. It was one of the only communities and town of color for black slaves. Allensworth was a slave. He became the first black chaplain in the army. He then took a band of African American people in the 1900s or so to the Philippines. And so there was mutiny, a lot of black folks that were in his contingent said, why are we killing other brown people? So a lot of black folks intermarried, they stayed there, and Allensworth came back, and he developed this town called Allensworth. And it was not well received by the white landowners and a lot of the white residents because it was so successful. They had a bank, they had an institution for learning, they had a little church, and they were pivotal in getting goods and services through their railway. And then the major railway came through and then diverted all traffic and goods and services away from Allensworth. So that became the demise of the town. In addition to that, there were land rights problems. So, I'm not lying, water rights wars. So what happened is that they diverted the water away from Allensworth, and that became a second addition to the death of Allensworth. So with no water, you cannot grow crops. With no water, you are going to die.
Right.
So the result, Allensworth was going to someplace, I think in Glendale, California, I can't remember now, to give a lecture of sorts. And supposedly it was an accident where he was walking down the street and some kind of motorbike at the time crashed through him and then killed him. We all know from my research, there was death threats on Allensworth, and people did not like the fact that this guy was uppity, as most of us know what that means. I'm not going to get into what that means, but they didn't like the fact that this man of color was successful. He was politically minded, articulate, and very, very bright.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up being on Doug McConnell's show, showing my pictures that I had took when I was there and shared my sense of connectedness to many of my history that I had never been told. And why not is this not being featured in our history books? We have been left out, just like my native ancestry, are left out of the books, history books, with one or two pages. You know, like a footnote.
Right. Yeah, and I want to mention to our audience that Allensworth, the town, is not far from Fresno, and in September they have a major homecoming celebration, and at that particular time there are trains that go from Northern California to Fresno to Allensworth and then come from Southern California up. And it's Allensworth is now a part of the regional park system, the state regional
right.
park system.
Right.
So so it's a historic landmark. And so it's just really wonderful. going to these homecoming gatherings where one is able to learn more about Colonel Allensworth and some of the earlier members of that community. Some of the children are still here, and they come and they talk, and there are different activities. You can make different crafts, and it's just really wonderful. And then they have people dressed up in the period costumes. It's just a really wonderful, wonderful day, for the whole family.
Well, you know, Wanda, I was doing research on Allensworth. I uncovered so much information that even his relatives didn't have. I was doing research, and I ended up contacting Lonnie Bunch, who is one of the directors now in the Smithsonian. He did a opening statement booklet for the show that was down in Los Angeles at the African American Museum down by USC. And I called him and I talked to him. He sent me some information. And on top of this, I ended up meeting one of Allensworth's grandsons. He actually lives here in the city. Mm-hmm. He works at a local store. He's been there forever. Mm-hmm. And he actually came to my place, and I actually gave him a bunch of information, that a big booklet, like 3-inch stuff of all my research. Because mm-hmm. I called down in Los Angeles to get research. I was calling all over the country to get research. So I ended up giving him this huge booklet that he said he was so thankful, because none of his family even knew some of the things I found out.
Wow, that is amazing. Well, we'll have to have you on again yet one more time, April, to talk about Allensworth. I think it's because there are a lot of black towns throughout this country. There are some even closer than Allensworth. I there's one in San Pablo County that I just heard about that still exists, but people don't know that it's a black town. It's founded by black people. So it's like, wow, that's really interesting. So, April, it's been, really fabulous speaking to you once again about your art and your work. And maybe we might have one more conversation to talk more about the textiles, that particular medium that is both tangible and is also a metaphor for so much of the work that you do. So maybe we'll do one more of these conversations, if you don't mind.
Well, I appreciate it. I also wanted people to know that I'm getting inspired by some more research I've done on Canada and the Underground Railroad, and also there's a part of Canada that there was a black, predominantly black town in Ontario, in Montreal, where a lot of the slaves went across for the Freedom Crossing. And they call it the Promised Land. So we have tons of black folks right in Ontario and in Montreal that people don't know about. And this passing was called Le Chemin de Fer, which is about the Iron Way in Canada. And U-Haul featured this on the sides of some of their travel, their call U-Haul buses. So I think I'm going to probably get inspired by this part of our history to continue this voyage of the treasured cigar box.
Okay. Well, thank you again, April, and looking forward to talking to you in the very near future, maybe next Wednesday.
All right. Thank you very much. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Peace and blessings. We are joined in the studio by, I believe, Aaron Washington. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. And are we joined by Mfoniso Udofia?
Can you hear me? I'm here.
Yes. Are you the other? Because I'm there. I was expecting one more person. So, are you in the studio?
Mfoniso.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because your sister, gosh, is not in the studio. So hopefully you all can represent for the MOAD Youth Media Program for her.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, because that was the convener for my being able to meet you two wonderful women, see your great play. God, I keep on tripping over your name. Say it for me again.
Mfoniso.
Mfoniso. That is so pretty.
Yeah.
and Aaron. So let's talk a little bit about the MOAD Youth Media Program, which is an interdisciplinary youth development and job readiness program featuring a rich mentoring environment and hands-on experiences to develop their media, arts, leadership, and communication skills. And program participants learn multimedia production skills while using digital technology to produce museum and web content. And a lot of the members of the program were, I think they might have all been present at the fundraiser last week, August 4th, where we were able to experience one of the, I guess the first of the trilogy of plays that you've written?
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us, you know, sort of about the program and why, you know, Aaron, why you and Mufaniso decided to lend your support to it.
Of course. So this program I was invited to by eToro to, this is Mufaniso, by the way, so I was invited by my eToro to come in and help bring.
Excuse me, Mufaniso, you're like echoing. Is there a way? I don't know. Are we on speakerphone or
no?
YouTube or?
Am I still echoing right now?
No, you sound a lot better now. Okay.
Okay. I apologize. I had to suddenly stand up. So. This is a program. I can't speak about every facet of the program,
nope.
But this is an amazing program. As you were saying, that brings in youth from the Bay Area to come in and work and really get hands-on with the media program. And the way that Aaron and I were involved intimately was we were teaching a class there, and we helped to teach a class on acting and dramatic presence in order to get ready for the play that they were bringing in.
Oh, okay. So you were actually a part of the program. Oh, that's great. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, Aaron, why don't you talk a little bit about the, because you're like, you know, you're at Ashland and, you know, you have your own, you know, production company, Soul Productions, which sounds really great. Look at your wonderful website. Yet you took time out of your busy schedule to participate in this youth program in San Francisco.
Yes. Well, at the basis of my work is the youth. So when I was in New York, where I live, I do a lot of work in Chelsea and in Harlem with different youth groups, which is a true blessing. So that's the core of my work. But I started Soul in 2009, a little while ago, and actually the first project that I did was a music concert called Soul Sensations. And the basis of the program is to get all independent artists together to showcase our work to our community, our Black community, and let us know that there are other artists out there other than the commercial artists that we see all the time on the radio stations. And so my first theater work that I worked on was actually with Mufaniso when she was writing The Grove. We actually went up to Philadelphia. She was like, I want to write a play. And so I was like, do it, sister, do it. And she stayed in the hotel room. And she hashed out a play in, like, under 8 hours. And I was like, this girl is a straight genius. So, you know, through the last 2 years, we've been developing the piece. We've had a couple of workshops in New York, which has been really, really cool. We've had some private sessions with different actors and different people around the country, and it's been really, really cool. So to come out to California and to bring this work was really great, because in 2009, we both graduated from the MFA program at ACT. So we knew San Francisco as MFA students. And so now it was great to come back to San Francisco again as theater professionals, coming and actually giving opportunities to other people of color in the Bay to participate in this type of work at the MOAD, and also bringing in former ACT students and giving them work as well. So that was like a true blessing. And then the caveat to be at the MOAD with the youth program was truly amazing. And I hope that the MOAD continues this conversation with artists in the city, especially Black artists, producing their work and having a conversation of diaspora in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really too bad, because I know you all mentioned that when you do production of The Grove, you know, afterwards there's a lot of times it's opportunity for the audience to interact and engage, you know, the director and the cast in conversation as a group. I mean, we're totally mm-hmm. able to do that, you know, as individuals. Because your play, Mufaniso, is, you know, it's really provocative. And then with this star-studded cast of actors and actresses that, oh, my God, it's just like, it was just fantastic.
Right.
Yeah, so I wanted to let you talk a little bit, not talk a little bit, talk a lot about the growth. But first I want to introduce you properly. I'm going to read your bios, and then we can talk some more. Udofia is a New York-based storyteller, actor, slam poet, and teaching artist. The first play in her installation is The Grove, and it's a 2012 Eugene O'Neill National Playwrights Conference semi-finalist, and she has a website that is her name. And then Erin Washington, yes, short and sweet. Erin Washington, as we already mentioned, is currently at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival as a fair apprentice for the American Revolution cycle, and I saw that cycle, and it's like, wow, it's too much.
Fierce.
And yes, it's fierce, and particularly during an election year. I'm so happy that they're doing it during an election year, because it really makes you think about the whole electoral process and democracy.
Oh, yeah.
It's just so perfect. I mean, it's a investment, you know, for the audience, not to mention the cast. You know, because it's like a play cycle. It's like Angels in America. It takes place over, I think, 6 hours of theater. So, you know, you're sitting there, you know, for a minute if you do it all in one sitting, you know, like with a little maybe lunch in the middle, in one day. I think that's the best way to do it. But it is so worthwhile. Because it talks about, you know, the government surveillance. I mean, everything that is, like, you thought was back then is right now. It predates the 9/11 and Bush Institute, you know, the one that took away our rights, and it was temporary, and then they had to ratify it and became I forgot
the Patriot
what
it, Act?
Yeah,
the Patriot
China,
Act?
Yeah, Patriot Act 1 and 2, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, well, there goes democracy in all intents mm-hmm. and purposes. But so wonderful that, you know, even when there are laws that take away our rights, we can write them again into law. That's one great thing about it. So, you know, elastic, you can, like, unravel it and sew it back together and unravel it, sew it back together. I don't know if there are any nations like this one. The one we're in. So, anyway, I'm just sort of took a little digression there. But, Erin, she already mentioned she just finished a new play producing fellowship in the American Voices New Play Institute at the Arena Stage. And she graduated from Florida A&M University with a BA in theater and later received her MFA, as she mentioned, in acting from American Conservatory Theater, where she grew her passion for the arts. And she already told us about in 2009 she started Soul Productions, a production company that exposes urban communities to emerging independent artists who are pioneering new approaches to music and theater. And she says, I am because we, capital W, capital E, are. Okay. So let's talk about The Grove for a minute. Wow, I mean, what a name. Why do you call it The Grove? And this character, you know, one might think, oh, it's, you know, it's a coming-of-age story, it's a coming-out story. But no, really, it's a story about this young woman who has no voice, and mm-hmm. she is silenced. I mean, and she has allowed herself, now she's sort of doing some self-reflection on, wow, I have allowed all these people to shut me down throughout my life. I'm just letting
right.
people shut me down at home, you know, in my personal love life. I'm just allowing myself to be shut down. Like, so if I had the courage to speak, what would I say?
Right.
And we don't know.
No, the audience doesn't get to see.
Oh, you're so unkind.
Yeah. The audience doesn't get to see what you would say. Mm-hmm. So before I even, like, go into that, it'd probably be good to, like, break down a little bit about what The Grove is, right?
Yes, please. Uh-huh.
So, The Grove is a play that centers around a main character named Adiaga, who is the eldest in a very traditional Nigerian family. This Nigerian family probably came over in the 1970s at some time. And as the oldest, she's the one who kind of keeps the family together and really serves as a conduit of the family's Nigerian traditions in America. So she holds a very specific role in the house. And she is a Caucasian woman.
You're kind of, something's happening. You're breaking up. Hello?
Hello? Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. I can hear you again.
I'm sorry. I think somebody was actually just trying to call in to me.
Okay.
So you
okay.
Probably heard the beeping.
Okay.
You
were talking about her traditional Nigerian family. What ethnic group?
So this is Ibibio, and it's in the southeast of Nigeria. Mm. And Ibibio sometimes gets a little confused with Igbo. And it's not the same people. It's a smaller group of people. And the languages there are like Efik, Ibibio, Anang. Those are all dialects that are happening in this part. And it's in a Kwaibom state in Nigeria. So, and a little bit into Cross River, I would say. The story is she's dating a woman named Kimberly. Her family finds out, and it's a real identity problem for Adiaga as she tries to figure out how she can live the life that she wants to lead while also maintaining a strong, healthy family life at home. And it's you're right, it's not really a coming out story as much as it is an identity and how do I talk? How do I find my voice? Especially as Adiaga... Adiaga is the name of the person, as well in our languages it means the oldest.
Oh, okay.
As she figures out how she can hold both worlds, especially in her Nigerian family where it is not her role to talk. So she literally doesn't have a vocabulary in that household. It is her role to hold things together, but she's not there for talking. So she has to learn on her feet in the play.
Yeah, but it seems as if her mother is also, she's not supposed to talk either. She's supposed to, except to affirm what her husband tells her is right and correct. But other than that, it's like, because so when she is, you know, when they're celebrating, because the occasion that when we meet Adiaga, she has graduated with honors from university,
right.
and they're celebrating this achievement. And her mother is invited in to help celebrate, and she's kind of shocked that they want her to come in, and then to say something too, and she is also speechless. So it's like, wow.
She is. But what's amazing, and I think this is something that people. I don't know how to explain it. There's a very fun thing with Ibibio women in that they look as if they're speechless, but they are the glue that holds the family together a lot of the times, the mothers. So if you look at the play, and it might be hard to see during the reading, there's a lot of action that these women hold. It's just not in words. Mm-hmm. And so Abasiyama's character might not be able to give a blessing formally in the way that the men give the blessing, but the way she wields her power is quite different. Because Abasiyama in the play has known that her daughter has been dating this woman and does not tell people. And so the power of her silence and the way she wields her power is very different than, say, a way an American woman would wield her power. So you're right, she doesn't have speech, but when she does have it, she knows how to wield it. And then she's using her power in other ways within the family.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. But, you know, I understood the unspoken power that she wielded. However, she said, you know, she didn't have the words. And then she went on to talk about, you know, what she and her daughter knew, what they shared. And I think it was the secret that sort of prevented her from giving a blessing because she disapproved of the relationship.
Exactly.
So she didn't want to be hypocritical and say
right.
something that she didn't mean. So anyway, I thought that was really, really intriguing. And I thought the other characters, you know, that you have, I particularly liked the brother and the
mm-hmm.
little sister, but the brother in particular because, you know, you're looking at the whole idea of American-born Africans.
mm-hmm.
You know, you've got the Abibio children, but they're Americans as well. And what do you do with that? And what happens to, you know, to a culture, you know, when it gets dropped in another culture and it becomes a minority? How do you keep that alive? And how do you keep the desire to keep it alive, you know, as a part of the family, you know, like, you know, how do you keep your children interested in their heritage?
Right.
When they see it's not working for you. You know, it's like, wow. And then you
mm-hmm.
said at one point when we were talking, you said our, so I presume this is your culture.
Yeah. BBO, okay. I'm BBO.
Yeah, I know. Because you said
yeah.
our.
Yes.
Yeah. So maybe we could. I want you to talk about sort of this the Grove in the context of the trilogy. But I want to bring Aaron in, and I want you both to talk for a minute about the cast and the casting, and they're just so phenomenal. And then I want us to come back and talk some more about the Grove and how. You know, how one is able to be both African and American.
Okay. In terms of the trilogy, The Grove is the first play of three, and the trilogy actually works itself backwards in time. So The Grove is the most present play set in 2010, and it is the play that has a real push and pull between American here, as in one act is completely devoted to a very American sensibility with Kim and the way that Kim and Adiaga, the two partners, interact. The second play is called Sojourners, and it's a play that is set in 1970s Houston, Texas, and it is the play of Disciple and Abasiyama, who are Adiaga's parents when they first come to America, and what it is to have the African dream meet the American dream.
Oh.
And where the American dream of a white picket fence and stability and the African dream for the sojourner class was to come to America, get studied, have a baby, go back home, and rebuild Nigeria. So when those two dreams clash and meet. So that's Sojourners.
Okay.
And then the third play is Run Boy Run, which is a verse play completely done in poetry, and it's 1968, the Biafran War, and it's Disciple story, and it talks about Nigerians and mental illness.
Really?
So,
ah.
Yes.
Ah.
So those are the three.
Yeah. So have you ever, Aaron, have you ever produced all three, like 1, 2, 3? Or 3, 2, 1?
Yes. So we've, of course, as we said, we've done readings of The Grove.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most development that we've done on all of the plays
mm-hmm.
in the trilogy. But we've also worked on Sojourners a bit. We've mm-hmm. done a couple of private workshops of that, just getting in a room with actors
mm-hmm.
And working on the script and Emmy's changing it every other time we do it. And now she has a fellowship coming up in the fall with the New Black Fest, which is an amazing institution in New York of black artists getting together to produce their own work. And that organization is going to actually take her even further in her development process of Sojourners. So watch out for that. New York, October, sometime in October, early October.
Okay,
yeah.
So when in October... funny. So, are you going to work all three? Are you going to work on all three of them?
No, in October, I'm just, like Aaron said, just working on Sojourners with the new Black Fest. So that's
oh, Sojourners, so number two. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we do have hopes of producing, like fully realizing the Grove in the summer of 2013.
Oh, super.
Either in New York or San Francisco.
Oh,
so,
San Francisco.
Yes. So,
let me help you bring it.
Yes, but of course, you know, we're producing a play. We have to raise money. We have to, you know, make sure that the cast that we've been working with from all over the country, we find that group of people that has the synergy and the energy to do it in either the East or the West Coast. But hopefully we can actually do it in both places.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's the next step.
For me, it's an exciting thing also because we're going to be, with producing The Grove, working outside the bounds of, like, an institution or a theater.
Yes.
This is an independent project where Soul Productions, which has been with the play for, I mean, about 2.5 years now, knows my work, knows what it is, and Soul Productions will come in with some community building, really reaching out into the African sector to pull people into the play. It's an exciting and hopefully going to be a real new way of staging and producing theater.
Just like Vanessa was talking about with community, we've noticed in the past and with working with other theaters that it's no disrespect, but the community aspect is not at the forefront. Usually raising money is at the forefront or making sure that you have all of these people there. Well, we want to make sure that in conjunction with seeing The Grove, that there's a very strong community aspect of us giving back to kids, so kind of what we did with the NYMP program, because we're both teaching artists, as well as education events around, like, what is it to be a Nigerian in America, and not even just to be Nigerian in America, but what is it to be first generation in America? Mm-hmm. How are you feeling? Like having some of the conversations and hopefully bringing us back to the spaces that we created in the American theater, the theater. We built the theaters, our people, you know, but now a lot of people feel ousted from this world because now it's a very homogenous place where homogenous stories are being told and our stories are not being told. So instead of waiting on somebody to give us approval, we are taking it and we are telling our stories our way.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I was just thinking about these, you know, the different parts, you know, the parents coming to Texas and you know, one learns early on in the piece that scholarship is really is something that the family really honors and is a part of you know their value system, and because the father, you know, he has a PhD disciple.
Mm-hmm.
And what
mm-hmm.
a name
right.
disciple. And the mother, I believe she also has a PhD. And they're both scientists, so she's in a non-traditional career, which is great.
She's doing
very well.
Yeah,
they're both
scientists.
She's
doing well.
Yeah.
She's a scientist. Disciple
researcher
is actually an academic. He's a researcher.
Right, but he's not doing well because of the mental illness you mentioned. And I like that you brought in, you know, this whole thing around the themes, you know, mental illness, immigrants, you know, and immigration and acculturization and assimilation, and you got, you know, parenting and, you know, how one raises one's children. You've got, you know, homosexuality as a theme. You know, you got a whole lot of religion, spirituality.
That's why there's three plays.
Yeah, it's a whole lot of stuff going on here, you know, in The Grove, you know, the culmination of the trilogy. And it's really interesting because here in California, a 2-year study just finished, and it was commissioned through the State Department on Health, looking at the mental health in the Black community for the state of California, and it was found really lacking in a lot of ways, and you know, and then we, you know, think about you know, mental illness is not something that people talk about a lot. I mean, there's a lot of stigma connected to mental illness, and the whole idea of, you know, getting treatment, you know, therapy and all that kind of stuff. I'm wondering if you could talk about, you know, just sort of how loaded, you know, your characters are. I mean, they're definitely, you know, fully fledged, breathing, you know, alive characters. They're not caricatures at all. I mean, and we really have empathy for Disciple, despite his, you know, his strangeness, to put it lightly.
Right. You know, but the thing is, for me, what I was grappling with while writing it is not, I don't know, I had to try to take away labeling and terminology. So it's, I'm actually surprised that I was the one who brought up mental illness just now, because when I was writing the play, I did not, would not allow that term to be used.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think anybody in the house is ready to put a term like that on top of him. I don't think he's ready to deal with such terminology. There is such silence around it. And I also wanted to write a fine line between what is illness and also what is just a cultural, I don't know what the word is, a cultural discrepancy. Because in Nigeria, the way Disciple acts in America, in Nigeria, would not be looked at as quite as ill. He would be kind of master of the house. There's a little bit of a, not only is it a little bit of a mental illness, but a little bit of a cultural psychosis kind of coming over. Our men historically do not do well coming over. There's a lot of loss in translation culturally between Africa and here, and the women do better in terms of, you know, letting go of certain cultural things and unfortunately or fortunately assimilating and raising their kids here in America. It's the men that have this problem. So with Disciple, it's also hard to tell which things are a mental illness and which things are a cultural learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really surprised when one of your cast, she portrays the mother,
Clara Kumunde?
Yeah, Clara. Yeah, she's Kenyan. And she said that a lot of times African men don't do well. And I'm like, "Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know." Talk about your family.
Mine? Oh no,
yeah.
I don't think I want to talk about
did your family immigrate, or were your parents born here and you and your sister born here as well? Do you have a connection to your BBO family in Africa still? Like, do you go back and forth?
Oh, of course I do. I mean, I don't go back and forth as some of my other families go back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
I've only been back once, and my parents have been back 3 or 4 times.
Okay.
So, but I do have a very strong connection, as in when aunts call, uncles call, you know, my mother will call me and I'll call them. You know what I mean? So I have a very good idea of what's happening across the water.
Okay.
But we don't go back, my particular branch, we don't go back quite as often as everybody else does.
Yeah, so you have facility with the language, like you speak your language?
You know what, I hear way more than I speak. And so even the language that I had in the play, I had to, like, dredge through memory to pull that out. But I hear fluently.
Yeah.
I speak quasi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, Aaron, you can speak to this too. So how is it to be both American and African? And to know your heritage,
mm-hmm.
in a way that those of us who are 500 years removed you know, we feel things, and we have mm-hmm. ancestral memory, I know for sure, because it's documented, and I know it within my person, and I'm not speaking as an individual. But it's not the same as being able to go back in my memory and pull up the language, like, because I heard it when I was a kid, like, not happening. Yeah.
I would say, I'm on your tip. I would say it's an amazing to be around Mfaniso while she's been creating this piece, to learn more about the ancestors. And me and friends have many conversations on this subject. This might be another radio broadcast.
Okay,
but,
sure. No problem.
No, I think that it's very interesting. You know, I have a lot of friends who are historians right now, and they're grappling with these questions of, you know, what does it mean to be American, with us of African descent? Like, are we American? Are we African-American? Like, what is the label for us right now? Because our connection, as you talked about earlier, is removed. We have not heard the language. You know, we're in a culture where we're not being taught about our own heritage and our own history, and it's not important. So I'm from Montgomery, Alabama. So I've never been to the continent, but I feel the spirits and the ancestors in my home, in Montgomery. And I know that is my home. I'm from there. But I do know that, you know, in my history, I am African, and I do hope to find that specific place where my people came from one day. But honestly, that is not something that my parents, when I was growing up, told me about. You know, I don't think that they've done as much research, but what they have done is shown me about community, which I feel like we also got from our African ancestors, you know? So, I don't know, I feel like we as African Americans are in an interesting space around our history and around where we came from, and I think right now is a critical time for us to think about like what we are and what we call ourselves and what is our commitment to going back. Like others have gone back in the past, you know, like Marcus Garvey and mm-hmm. Du Bois and many others. So because now, yeah. I mean, culture is interesting. It's crazy. It's like on TV, people want to be Kim Kardashian, you know. We have a less of a grip of who we are because it's not in the media. It's not, you know, on commercial TV. You cannot see yourself, you know. So we're at a very, very, very interesting space, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And the whole thing with having a president who is African and
yes.
American. I mean, he's like
yes.
really African, like you, Mfaniso. But he didn't know. But he's like us too, Aaron. He's like us.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know his African heritage.
Mm-hmm.
He had to,
mm-hmm.
he just like us. I mean, unfortunately, because he could have. He could have been more primary because his father, you know, is not like going 400 years, 500 years ago. His father
yeah.
was present, but he wasn't present.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, these are things, though, that we really also, as a group, need to talk about. Like, as African-Americans, there's so much nuance within the diaspora that we truly don't talk about. And, like, even with Obama, there were times where it was African-Americans going, but he's not really African-American. You know, there's all these things that we don't talk about that can be, in the end, divisive. So we need to, and that's why I'm so excited that it's Soul Productions is going to be producing, because there's going to be this ability to have a community forum and to really, amongst ourselves, too, talk about the complexities within the word African-American, because I'm African-American, and you, Wanda, are African-American, and so is Aaron, African-American, and how much nuance and difference, but still genuine honesty, are all three of our African American.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, yeah, because it certainly is, you know, as you move through the generations, it shifts.
Yeah, of
you
course.
Know, African American in 2012 is different from African American, you know, in 1997 or 1982, you know, yes. 1958. I mean, you know, you sort of it shifts. I mean, certain things hold firm, but then other things become more fluid. I mean, because you look nowadays, you know, some people don't claim the African part. It's just I'm an American. And
yes. Mm-hmm.
And when you travel, I'm sure you've noticed this, Ufaniso. I'm not certain what your passport says, but you know, when I travel to Senegal and to Gambia and to Mali and to Madagascar, and not to Paris because that's a Western country, I wasn't African American. I was just the American. They would, like, say on the street, like, where's the American? They wouldn't, like, where's the black American? Just, where's the American?
And to tell you the truth, me going to Nigeria as half American and then also being Nigerian, I would still be considered more American over there than I would be Nigerian.
Mm-hmm.
Our identity shifts when you shift where we are and how we are and the decade and, you know, so there always needs to be constant conversation so you don't assume a generality all of a sudden.
Right, right, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, definitely. One box does not fit all, for sure.
No. No.
Wow. Well, this has been certainly a wonderful conversation, and I didn't, you all didn't, and I know we're sort of out of time, but I really want you to sort of talk about your cast. Because they were, like, phenomenal, like, call their names. And
they were fierce.
Yes.
Yeah, so the casting was so, like, just by chance. We usually have a crew in New York that we love to death, and we work with them all the time, but couldn't afford to fly them to the West Coast. So we reached out to, actually, Mfaniso reached out to casting directors in California that we knew. And then some students were there from ACT, so that was really cool. So we had, Michael Asbury, Clara Camonda. Amaze Edehenry, Chelsea Lyons, who was phenomenal, 18-year-old, first time doing a play. She was fantastic.
Really?
At Toyima. Yeah, that
wow.
was her first time doing a play.
Wow, that's why she kept on getting applause.
Yeah, no, she got applause because she is phenomenal.
She's phenomenal because some people knew the backstory that she's phenomenal. She's more phenomenal. I didn't know that this was her first acting gig because
yes,
she was
yes.
really great.
Yeah,
yes,
she was great. Mm-hmm. And then Marcus Henderson actually flew up from L.A., thankfully,
wow.
and played Udom. And he brought really, really great energy.
Mm-hmm. Was Marcus the guy who stood up for the mother?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, loved him. He had this real nice. He had some kind of what do you call the seeds? You know, seed necklace around his
yes.
neck. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. He really brought the Africa to the piece.
Yeah.
To the piece. I mean, like he was like he just had like some real phenomenal energy.
Marcus is truly embodied in the way that I think you'd see like a lot of African uncles being.
Oh.
He was in his body, Marcus. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
It was wonderful.
Yeah. And who was the other uncle? He was good too. I really liked him.
Tai.
Okay.
Tai, yes.
Tai Tillman.
Yeah,
he's in his third year at ACT right now.
Oh, okay, yeah, Cosmos is such an African name. I know so many Cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we had
Aaron
Moreland, who played Ekong, young guy. Yeah, brother.
Oh, was that the brother?
Mm-hmm. And
he was also
his second year at ACT.
Oh, he was
his second
great,
year.
Great. He was really great. Yeah.
And then Anna Ishida, who was playing Kim.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Anna Ishida. Came
yeah.
in and we found her, and she was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
An amazing kid.
Yeah, she was great because she had to go against those parents. Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like morphing her because she's a little person, like physically. And so they were like, so here is disciple, you know, and then there's, you know, the mom, how do you pronounce it?
Abasiyama.
Yeah, and Abasiyama, you don't mess with her. It's like, you know,
no.
You ain't my blood, girl.
Yeah, and Clara did an amazing,
yeah, I will
amazing
thank you.
Job.
Yes. Yeah, she was Whew, man, fierce.
We were blessed with a great cast.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And also Michael Asbury brought a lot of neon,
too. Big shout to Michael.
Too.
Big shout.
Oh, of course, yeah. Because I saw Michael when I was when I was walking into the Museum of the African Diaspora, and he said he was in the play. I'm like, oh. He said, and I said, you don't ever let me know when you're in a play. I just sort of happened to, you know, sort of stumble into it, you know, wonderfully, you know, thankfully. And so anyway, I didn't know when he told me. He didn't tell me that he was, like, the father. And I'm like, well, look at Michael. He's got, like, a central role in this play. Oh, my God.
He's the one keeping
they were
act one together.
Mm-hmm.
They really were. We were blessed with a great cast.
Yeah.
And we only had about maybe, 13 hours of rehearsal?
So
13 to 16. So they did an amazing job with the time given.
The script is like 100 and something pages long. Each actor brought a lot of life to bring that together.
Wow, that is just really phenomenal. And I am so looking forward to seeing this work fully realized, all three parts of it. And then, you know, I'm sure you're still writing, right?
I am. I actually just wrote for a festival 2 days ago. So I'm writing the trilogy and I'm writing other things.
I'm
writing. Yep.
And you're an actress, you know, and you're a performance artist, and you know, so you're working too. How do you juggle all those things?
I don't know. Erin's also an actor. She's not acting as much right now, but we both have our training from ACT.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you juggle what you juggle, but I do know that when you want to do something, it gets done.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I can't answer that one. I want to, but I don't know how.
And I will say that one of my mentors, I never got to meet her, but I always feel her in spirit, Bea Richards, that, you know, when she first moved to L.A., she was like, I'm a dancer and I'm an actress, but I'm also a teacher, I'm a literary person, I'm a writer, I'm everything. So I think we kind of take that to its fullest extent and just know that the word artist means all. And I think really at the base of it, the community work is what I think drives us both to continue to go on. So, that is the most important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you all want to give your website, spell them out for folks, particularly yours, Mufaniso, because I don't know if people will be able to spell your name otherwise.
Okay. You can find out about my work, my stuff, at www.mfunisodafia.com. So that's www.mfunisodafia.com.
Yes, and you can find out about me, Erin Washington, and my production company, Soul Productions, at www.soulproductions.info. And also, if you're on Twitter, you can hit me up at Soul, SoulPrDTS. That's my Twitter handle.
Super. Well, once again, thank you both so much for, you know, finding some time in your busy schedules to talk about your work and this wonderful program at the Museum of the African Diaspora Youth Media Program, which can take money. So you can, if you weren't able to make the fundraiser, you can certainly get in touch with MOAD. They're right there on Mission at 3rd Street in the Yerba Buena Gardens area of San Francisco. And the address is 685 Mission Street. And the phone number there is 415-358-7200. And their website is moadsf.org. So they have some great things going on because they have this wonderful painting exhibit, and they're going to be having artists in a round table with the curator, Lizetta LaFalle Collins, this weekend. What is it, the 11th, 12th, and then the following weekend they're doing some more stuff. So it's just a wonderful, wonderful place, and it's just they just have so much going on. And these women, you know, were part of making something really powerful happen this past weekend. And really looking forward to seeing your play and seeing you do some of your poetry and Mufaniso. And gosh, Erin, if I could get up to Ashland, man.
Please just come to Ashland, and then you can have the cast on your radio show, the party people.
Okay. No. How long is Ashland going?
We're going to be going until November the 3rd.
Oh, for a while. Okay. Yeah. Let me try to get up there then. Okay. I got a minute. Sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I will be in touch about that.
Cool. Thank you so much for having us on your show.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank
good luck
you
in all
so
of your
much.
Projects. Oh, you're so welcome. You're so welcome. Thank you. You take good care.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Peace and blessings.
On the move, everybody, all the activists, all the righteous folks that want to get on the move, this is Delbert Africa of the Move Organization. I won't be long, but I just want to say the Move Organization is taking this opportunity to speak out about the 34 years of imprisonment of the innocent Move 9. We were first railroaded, arrested in August 8, 1978, where one cop was killed. Philadelphia District Attorney's Office claims that 9 MOVE members fired one bullet into one cop and subsequently gave all 9 of us 30 to 100 years. Our battle now is with this unjust parole board's decision to keep on giving us these hits, putting us back year after year, claiming that because we refuse to admit to the so-called responsibility of our alleged crime, that they can't let us out. And the MOVE organization is sick and tired of letting these people get away with these excuses, and we are urging people to get on the move and do something about it. Help us fight this unjust prison parole board's decisions. Ever since we first came up for parole in 2008, we have been fighting this stigma of they saying we're not ready. Each and every MOVE member has completed all our programs. We got like 15, 19 years misconduct free. We've taken away all the excuses that these parole boards give. They have had other people that have had charges on them, that have been guilty, and yet they get parole. And we're encouraging people to keep on writing and calling parole board on behalf of the MOVE 9, and in fact, any other prisoners, to point out these examples to these parole members. Make them justify their position. These parole officials have been keeping our family in prison under the guise of justice like we guilty of murder, and they the ones that should be guilty. In 1985, these foul demons came down on our family, murdered 11 MOVE members and animals that were in the house, burnt down 4 square city blocks, and yet not one public official has ever went to jail for this, has even been charged with a crime for this, as if this cop, James Ramp, that was killed in 1978, who we didn't kill, like his life is more valuable than anybody else's. And here it is time now in 2012 that these people are once again giving MOVE members hits. In other words, saying that we're not eligible for parole. We've had community support from around the world. We've had people from around the world that said, okay, they'll take us in. And yet this Pennsylvania Parole Board is continuing its unjust and, in fact, illegal and wrong stance of keeping MOVE people in prison. And so this is what we want to do is urge everybody. This August 8th, flood the parole board of Pennsylvania hotline with even more calls and make them justify their position. I'd like to give you the parole hotline number in Pennsylvania. It's 717-772-4343. And I'm urging people, call them up. Let them know how you feel about this unjust imprisonment where they can keep people that they know are innocent of the crime of murder in 1978 in prison for another year, another 2 years. If we were weak, if we had been on this prison activity and come to the parole board whining and crawling, they would have been and let us out and told the world, look, we done broke them. But because we maintained the same strong revolutionary stance that we came into prison with, then they refused to let us go. And that's all that is. MOVE people are strong, and we came in strong, and we're staying on this activity strong. And that's what makes these people mad. That's what makes them angry. John Africa, our coordinator, has shown each and every MOVE member how very necessary revolution is. And because of our uncompromising example, people all over the world have chosen to get on the MOVE. And this prison board and the state officials and Seth Williams, the Pennsylvania district attorney, recognize the power. And that's why they don't want us on the street. And we urging people, call up and demand that they justify their position and tell them that you know that all they're doing is making excuses about letting us out. So I want to thank Prison Radio for this time. I have to go, and I hope for the chance to communicate with people on the outside again through this phone line. But our phone time is up, and I got to go. So on the MOVE to everybody, and keep on fighting, because we're going to keep on fighting in here.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Right. Thank you, Delbert Africa, for the statement about the MOVE 9. And we are joined in the studio with Michael Africa Jr., and he's the son of political prisoners Michael and Debbie Africa, who are part of the MOVE 9 that are incarcerated still 34 years to date. He was born in prison in 1978, 1 month after the August 8th confrontation between the MOVE organization and the city of Philadelphia. And he says his goal in life is to fight for release with his family. Welcome to the show, Michael, and thank you so much for joining us today on this historic date.
On me. Thank you for having me.
Oh, no problem. Glad you could, I didn't know you were going to be at work, so I'm really happy that your work schedule allows you, you know, this flexibility to talk about your family and being born behind, you know, prison walls and your life for the past 34 years, having your mother and father, Michael and Debbie Africa, behind bars, as well as the other members of your family. I was wondering if you could talk about the significance of this day and because it's almost like a birthday almost for you because you were born a month later. But anyway, I was wondering if you could talk about the significance of the day and why it's important that all of us, pay heed to what has happened to the MOVE 9.
Well, I mean, for most people, August 8th is a day that comes around once a year. But for me, August 8th is a day that I live every day. When they came to our house and raided the house and arrested all those people, and arrested my mother and my father in there, that was something that the whole world saw happen. But that's something that I live every day because, you know, I'm still feeling the effects of that day, you know. And ever since I've been aware of my people being in prison, I've been fighting ever since, you know. It's a real injustice. It's a real injustice, you know. And like Delbert was saying when he was on, how, you know, it's just the parole board, how they're just going to refuse them parole because they're saying, you know, they don't even really give a legitimate reason. They just keep saying the same thing. You know, they won't acknowledge an admission of a crime or whatever. But the fact is, the judge who sentenced them to that 30-year minimum, 100-year maximum, admitted that he didn't know who killed police. So, you know, for them to do that and just keep denying our people parole, it's just ridiculous. You know, and people, like Del said, I urge people to get on the MOVE and start doing something about it, too. And if you have been doing something, keep doing something. And if you ain't been doing nothing, get on the MOVE and do something. You know, write some letters. Talk to the parole board. Get on, you know, he gave the number, and people need to call that number and stay on it. Make it a weekly thing, whatever, you know. But, you know, for them to just keep denying my people parole like they have been, it's a crystallized example of how they just don't want people, you know, move people on the street. They just want to be nasty. They just want to be mean because they got people that they parole all the time. I'm talking about people that are sex offenders. I'm talking about people that are child molesters. I'm talking about people that are murderers that they know committed the crime, the people that will admit that they did it. And they grant them parole all the time, you know. And here it is, 34 years later, after them people been in prison all of those years. During that time of 34 years, there have been so many situations where people been released because they found out, you know, through some DNA evidence or through some kind of technicality, the people was innocent, and they did 25 years in jail, 40 years in jail. They let Geronimo Pratt out of prison because, you know, they couldn't find nothing on him. He did all of those years in prison. He wasn't even nowhere near where the crime supposedly had taken place. You know, it's just ridiculous that they just want to keep people in here in prison like that and keep people separated, keep their families separated from each other. And it's even more ridiculous that people allow it. People don't realize how much power the masses have. You know, they don't realize it. But the reality is the government, the politicians, they tell you every week or every 4 years to get out there and vote. Get out there and, you know, support me, support me, support me. They do that because they know that the people have the power, and if you support them, then you're going along with what they're about. But the same way that people get out there and vote by the millions like that, if people get out there and demand change by the millions the same way, then we'll get some justice. But people got to do it. But people are so involved in, you know, the things that the system has set up for them to be involved in so that they're not focused on things that really matter. They're focused on things that don't really matter. They're focused on once a year anniversary holidays and birthdays and Christmases and Thanksgiving. That's the stuff that's important to people because that's the stuff the system has put out there for people to believe in. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you start talking about, you know, come on, man, I'm going down here to make a change. I'm going down here to this demonstration to do something. You might see a few thousand people out there out of how many million people are actually here in this country. You know, and it's just, you know, people got to understand how important it is. MOVE is taking a stand, but we're not just taking a stand for us. It's not for just us. This is for everybody else, the sons and daughters, too, because we're fighting for the air that everybody got to breathe. We're fighting for the water that everybody got to drink. You know, so it's not just a thing for us. You know, and you know, for people to just, for the government and the parole board to just refuse our people parole is just ridiculous, especially the women. The women don't even have any weapons charges on them. The cop was killed with a bullet from a gun. The women don't even have a weapons charge on them. But, you know, they're keeping them in prison too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Tell us, maybe you could name the other seven prisoners from your family. You've got your mother and your father, and and then there are other parents as well as your mother and father.
Absolutely, Janet Africa. Janet Africa's her daughter was murdered on May 13th, 1985, and she's still in there. Deneen Africa, her son was murdered on May 13th when they dropped their bomb the same day as Janet, and she's up there. They're both up there with my mom. Janine Africa, also her 3-week-old baby was the one that was murdered by the police, who was knocked out of her arms and he was trampled. He was 3 weeks old. His name was Life Africa, and that was in March 1976. And those two women up there are up there with my mother, and they suffer from the hands of the abuse of this system for a long time, even before August 8th. You know, and then after August 8th, dropping a bomb on their children, you know. Delbert, he was on the tape. He was on the show earlier. His daughter was murdered on May 13th, you know. Chuck Africa, he's in there. He's been in there ever since he was 18 years old.
Wow.
He's been in prison since he was 18.
Wow.
You know, he was barely a minor. He was just out of being a minor when that, you know. Also, Bill Africa, he had two kids murdered by the police by the city of Philadelphia as a result of them brutalizing people. Who else is there? Eddie. Eddie, he was in the house August 8th. He's still in prison right now. And Delbert was the one that you heard on the tape. And then my dad.
And then Merle Africa, she died in prison, right?
Yeah. Yeah, she did 20 years in there, and she died. They said that she, I don't know the whole the details of it, you know, but they said that they gave some kind of reason why she died. It was something, but you know, I really didn't get into a whole lot of details about how she died or whatever, because You know, it's as far as we're concerned, she was in there. She was healthy. She was strong. She was just like the rest of the movement members. She was healthy. Physically, she was healthy and she was strong. Mm-hmm. For her to just die at 49, I think it was, it's just, you know, we don't believe it. We don't believe that she just died of natural causes. That don't make any sense. You know, but, you know, with all of the underhanded, scheming, sneaky ways of the government, I don't doubt at all that they had something to do with her dying, at all. You know, so.
Yeah. Can you talk about how you happened to, you know, you were born there? Tell us the story of your birth and what happened. You know, when Janine Africa announced your presence to the court and just, you know, what it's been like, you know, growing up without your parents, you know, and moving from one relative to another until you finally get back to, you know, to move when you said, I believe, Ramona Africa, when she got out of prison, she was only adult survivor of the bombing. May 13th, 1985, when she came and got you, you said. So you sort of tell us that story, starting with your birth.
Well, it's funny that you say that because I talk to Janet. Move people are very close to each other. Mm-hmm. When I go see my mom, I never go see my mother without going to see the other girl.
Right.
Like if I can't bring the other ones out, I don't go. You know, So Janet and I, we're very, very close to each other. We talk a lot. And I asked her, because I read the transcripts of some of the transcripts of the trial in 78, and I asked her, I said, why did you tell them I was in there? Why didn't you let me be? She said, I had to tell them. She said, I didn't want to. She said, I really did not want to. I wanted you to be able to be with your mother as long as you could. She said, but I had to tell them because if I had not told them and they found you in there, they would have killed you. They would have killed you and tried to make it look like you never existed. So what I did was, this is what she said. She said, I announced it in court so that it could be on the record so that they could not say that you did not exist, because they've done that in the past where a new baby was born, and because the baby didn't have a birth certificate, because new women have the babies at home, they tried to say the baby never existed, even though we had pictures, and they, some public officials came in to see the baby after the police had killed the baby. But they would have tried to say that you didn't exist. So I announced it in court that you existed, and when I was reading the transcript, I was reading her. She said it over and over again. Debbie Africa just had a baby. He's strong. He's healthy. And she was just running it, talking about, you know, how when I was born, I've been in there for 3 days. And, you know, she was just running the information. And they denied it at first. They did exactly what she said. They denied it at first. Debbie didn't have no baby. She we've been watching her around the clock. We've been watching all her movie people. She did not have a baby. We've been watching. And Janet kept announcing that I was born over and over again until she made the judge throw her out of the courtroom. And when the judge threw her out of the courtroom, they sent the guards to check. And when they sent the guards to check, they sent her back to her cell, so therefore she could see them as they were coming to get me. And that way she could make sure that she prepared my mother and made sure that everything was safe so that I could get out of there safely without them trying to do anything to eliminate. And that was quick thinking on her part, because, you know, it was quick thinking and it was very protective, you know, and that's how John Africa taught us to be with each other, you know, be protective of each other. And so she did that, and that you know, I actually didn't ask her that until maybe about a year or two ago. For all these years, I just thought that, you know, she did it just to, I don't know what I thought. But she did it to, you know, to make sure that I was safe. And then, you know, when he took me out of there, I went and stayed with my aunt. My aunt raised me for the first few years, and she left the organization. My grandmother left the organization because I was living with them, and they took me out of the organization. And I was gone for 8 years. And in 1992, when Ramona came home, she came and got me either the day after she got home or the next day or whatever. It wasn't long after she came home, a couple days at the most. She came home and she came and got me, and I've been back and move ever since. That was May of 1992, and I've been back and move ever since.
Right, yeah. So talk about what it's like to grow up as a member of MOVE, you know, sort of the philosophy of the organization and, you know, the type of people or the type of person that you've developed into, and you're a father too, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And what type of parent you are.
I'm blessed. Listen, MOVE people are strong-willed, determined. You know, we don't when we believe what's right and we know what's right, we don't stop at anything short of fulfilling righteousness, you know. Okay, I'll give you an example of what I mean. When people say things, talk about our belief and our philosophy or whatever, we don't have a philosophy. Because philosophy, that's like, you know, you can debate that, you can challenge that, you can argue with it or whatever. No, well, see, we don't believe in that. We believe in what's right. We believe in the sun. You can debate it all you want, but it's still going to shine. We believe in the rain, the air, you know, the soil. We believe in things that we know we need. And that's all we believe in. And, you know, the government, they don't, these politicians and these judges, they barter the water. You know, they barter it. They'll sell off a certain, they'll sell off the water and let the water be chemically contaminated so that, you know, some industrialist can build some nuclear plant that's going to kill millions of wildlife, millions of people. You know, and this is why MOVE exists, because we don't believe in just, you know, seeing life as something that you can just abuse and misuse and contaminate. And, you know, as long as I'm on the other side of the river, you know, I'm not worried about what goes in it. You know, that's why MOVE exists. That's why the politicians and the judges particularly came at MOVE so hard, because they'll go out there, they'll sign the order for DuPont to build this nuclear plant on the banks of the river, and you know, as long as they can breathe their Swiss Alps air, they don't care about what's going on in Camden and North Philly and in the ghettos of Los Angeles or whatever, you know. But MOVE understands that all life is connected. It's all connected. When you look at the map and you see the seven different oceans, all of those different oceans, they teach you in school that there's seven different oceans. There's the Atlantic, there's the Pacific, the Indian, all of these different oceans. But when you look at the map, you look at all of that water, it's all connected. It's all connected. When you look at the land and you realize that the land is connected to the water and the water is connected to the land, if you pollute any of it, you're polluting all of it.
Right.
You know, and it's just, you know, for people to just not care about that stuff and act like it's not important just because it's so, as they see it, far away from them. Well, look, at one point, the system was not close to anything. It was, you know, in some remote location that wasn't accepted by people, wasn't accepted by anything, you know, but it grew because it's just like a cancer. If you don't cut it off and remove it, it's going to grow. It's going to get worse. And before you know it, you know, it's going to spread throughout your whole body. And that's exactly what it's doing. And, you know, when you look at, like, how they develop neighborhoods, you know, one day you see the forest is green, it's got trees, it's providing all of this oxygen for people. The next minute you see buildings and smog and blacktop and pollution and the water's poisoned. And, I mean, it's, look, the food don't taste like it used to. the water ain't pure like it used to. That one, listen, I'm only 33 years old. But when I was a kid, you could drink water straight out of the tap and didn't even bat an eye to it. And you didn't have to worry about getting sick from it. Can't do that now. Now you got to buy water, you know, and give them more time. Give the system more time. And guess what? You're going to be walking down the street with oxygen masks on your face because you're not going to be able to breathe the air because it's going to be so polluted that it will make you sick breathing it. You know, and that's what MOVE it exists because MOVE, the name MOVE, the name of the organization, MOVE, it means to move, not stagnate. That's why it's called MOVE, because you've got to move. The system makes you stagnate. That when they put you in prison, you're in a 6'5", 8-foot cell. How much movement can you get from that? You know, and that's what their whole thing is. Freeze, stop, don't do anything. Even police, when they stop you, first thing they say is freeze. I mean, that's the way the system is. They want you to stagnate. They don't want you to circulate. They don't want you to move. You know, and growing up in MOVE, I came back in MOVE when I was 13. my kids started MOVE. I teach them the teaching of John Africa. I teach them about John Africa. And, you know, I teach them that nothing is more important than doing what is right, understanding what is right. Ain't nothing more important than that. Nothing. Because everything that you see, all of this stuff that's wrong, all of it, any of it, can come back to you, any of it. Politicians will put MOVE people in prison, but the prison system, the prison complex, industrial complex, that thing ain't set up for MOVE people. They didn't build that stuff just to house MOVE people. They built that. That stuff is built for people, period. Now you're getting politicians' sons are going to jail, police kids are going to jail, you know, and it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse. It's not a thing where the prisons are built just for MOVE people. I mean, there's only 9 MOVE people that's locked up with a 30-year minimum and 100-year maximum. But there's millions of people in prison, you know. So and here's the other thing. It ain't just for black people either, because the ratio of black and white is far more different than people would think. There's a whole lot of white people in prison. Poor white people are treated the same way that black people are treated. They're treated the same way. You know, I mean, this country is what, 74% white? So a whole lot of white people here with a black president. I mean, that's kind of odd. Kind of odd. You know, and it's not a thing where, you know, black people are just getting better and they're making it and all of the stuff. You know, we're overcoming and we're all of that, like people are saying. It ain't got nothing to do with that. This country is backwards. It's backwards. And presidents can't change it. Politicians can't change it. Politicians is the cause of this problem. They're the cause of it. And they keep the judges. And the judges keep, you know, the police and all of that stuff is all working together. The prisons are there so that the higher ups can make a lot of money. That's a private entity. They're making a lot of money off of those prisons. It ain't there to stop crime. If prison was the answer to crime, then how come crime is increasing? If prison is the answer to crime, seems like to me they would have to build one prison and that's it. But prisons are popping. In 1981, when some MOVE people went to prison, when they went upstate, there was 8 state prisons in Pennsylvania. By 1993, there were 23 state prisons in Pennsylvania. Hmm. And people aren't getting better. They call prisons correctional facilities. If they correct, who are they correcting? What are they correcting? You know, so, you know, look, it's for me, it's an honor and a privilege to be able to see and understand information like this so that I can defend myself against this kind of nonsense, because people believe anything you tell them. I remember we were talking the other day, I was talking to my brother, and we were talking about how the system used people for money, to get money so that they can make money. And people don't even understand it. When the cell phones first came out, they were these giant things. You had to have half of it in your car, in the trunk of your car, and the other half was like a giant VCR you had on, you know, that you took two hands to hold sometimes. And, you know, they were big, really big phones. And, you know, the, you know, and as they got so-called better, they got smaller and smaller to the point where people wanted small phones. Now they're starting it to get big again. But people that didn't like the big phones upgraded to the smaller phones, and now they're upgrading back to the big phones. It's like the iPod, I think it's called. That was like a little tiny. It was a certain size, and then it got smaller. And now the iPad is out, and the iPad is bigger. Now they like the bigger one. It's not even based on what they like. It's about what's new, what's fashionable, what the system put here for you to like. That's what people go after. Doesn't mean that they don't even have to like it. It's popular. It's the thing. It's in. It's hip. It's cool. Whatever. And that's how it is with the system. If they introduce something to people, generally people like it. Even if they don't like it, they want it, and then they go after it.
Yeah.
There's a thing where they were announcing that in 2024, they're going to take the first people on a one-way trip to Mars. Did you hear about this?
No.
I think it's 2024, one-way trip to Mars. It's a one-way ticket. You're not coming back. You're going up there. You know, and it's like, for what? For what? For what? I mean, what's the point of leaving this place? What's the point of even wanting to leave this place? They expect this place to not be any good. That's why they're up there dropping bombs on the moon, trying to see if they can find any water, because they know that the water here is so polluted that you better not drink it. So they're trying to go to another place. You know, it's a shame, really. It's a shame, and it ain't going to get better.
Yeah. So, when's the last time you visited your family, and you know, how are their spirits? It's been a long time, 34 years, going, you know, before the parole board and being denied. Is anyone's parole coming up that we should be aware of when we're calling in? Let me give that number that Delbert Africa gave. It's area code 717-772-4343. 717-772-4343.
My mother got a 1-year hit just this past May, I think it was. She won't come up for parole again until May. I think it's May. The middle of May, they start getting them ready for parole meetings. And that's generally all of them, because they all, you know, got the same, it's the same day. So it's always around the same time.
Okay.
And how are their spirits? They're strong. They strong. I don't really think about. I've never been to prison before, so I don't really think about the different things that they have to deal with, and they don't really talk about the different things they have to deal with. You know, I'm talking about the detail things, the detailed part of being in prison. They just talk about, you know, how. They want to know how we're doing, how we're living, how we're maintaining. Mm-hmm. You know, are their grandkids strong? That's how they talk.
Right.
But they sometimes, every now and then, you might get a glimpse of the things that they have to deal with in prison, and the parole board is one of them. They get really fired up, you know, when they have to meet the parole board. And I talk to them and I ask them, well, you know, what are you going to say? And they say, I don't know. And I say, well, you don't have anything prepared? They say, well, I mean, you know, it's the same thing as I've been saying for you know, and I'll ask them, like, well, you know, what if they say this? They say, listen, you know, if they keep calling me a murderer, I'm going to keep saying I ain't a murderer. You know, and that's all there is to it. You know, I'll be shocked. Like, I'm not shocked that they're strong. It's shocking to me that they have the same attitude and the same, they use the same word. It's the same thing. And it's been this way ever since I can remember, you know. So they're very strong. They're very strong. They're very, their mindset is very strong. It never changes. It never wavers.
Yeah. So how was it, you know, when you were, you know, a young child growing up, visiting your parents, you know, behind bars, and when did you come to realize the enormity of the sentence and that, you know, sort of, you know, the loss, the personal loss of that parent-child relationship?
I don't really know when I came to realize that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's always been that way.
Yeah.
So I don't really know when I understood it. It's always been that way. I mean, ever since I can remember, I've been saying, free my mother, free my father. You know, so I don't really know when you're a kid, you don't think of 30 years as being a long time when you are looking forward to your mother and father coming home. You know, and aside from that, Moon people never told me, like, you know, I would ask him, you know, when do you think they'll come home? And they would just say, they'll be home soon, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping my mind off of any kind of, anything that would make me concentrate on how long it actually be. Because there ain't no hope in that. You know, you tell a 10-year-old, your mother ain't coming home for 20 more years at least. You know what I mean? Like, how am I supposed to respond to that?
Right.
You know, what am I supposed to say?
Mm-hmm.
That's, there ain't no hope in that. I mean,
right.
Most people don't believe in, you know, leaving people with no hope. So they would just say they'll be home soon. And that, you know, got me to the point where I could understand. You know, it helped me. You know, and then when I could understand time a little better when I was a teenager, by then I could understand that they may never come home. They may never come home because it is an unjust system. It may happen where they never get home. You know, and then I started thinking of it that way. But I didn't get depressed about it. I got fired up about it because here is the system who know that they're innocent, going to just keep them in prison. That's more of a reason for me to fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's more of a reason for me to, you know, stay strong myself and follow their example. You know, I mean, look, they dropped a bomb on May 13th and killed 11 people, okay? Now, if they would do that and kill 11 people, that's clear indication that they out for blood. Why would they let my people out? You know, so that's why we got to just keep on fighting and keep on pushing, you know, because it's a very strong possibility that, they're trying to keep them people in there forever.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to keep them there forever. They ain't trying to let them out.
Yeah. So when the bomb was dropped, you weren't living there at that time, right? Or were you?
No.
Okay.
No. I don't know where I was at that time. I was about 6 years old or so. I don't know where I was.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember exactly. I remember things happening there. At that time, there was a lot of chaos. I remember that. But I was so young, I don't really remember. Like, you know how you can say, well, where were you when O.J. verdict was read? I remember exactly where I was then because I was older and I remember the racial tension that, you know, I remember, you know, where were you when the World Trade Center was hit? I remember exactly where I was because at that time I was a grown man who could understand things. But at that point, when that bomb was dropped, I was 6 or 7 years old, something like that. And I don't really remember. I just remember the atmosphere. I just remember the feeling. Everybody seemed to be on edge. Everything was chaotic. I don't even think I was in MOVE at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think think by then they had taken me out. And I just but I remember them because they were at one time close to those people. Mm-hmm. My aunt and my grandmother, they were at one time they were close to those people. So I remember them being very quiet, but there was a vibe, there was a certain vibe that I remember feeling. And, you know, and it lasted for a couple of years because I remember at that point they put me in school, and I remember even in third grade. I mean, they put me in first grade. I went through first grade. I went through second grade. Even by third grade, that vibe that I remember feeling around that time was still there. Mm-hmm. It was a very weird feeling. But after that, when I came back to move people, because my grandmother and my aunt, they never explained anything to me. Mm. What was happening, why it was happening, you know, the children that were in that house that I used to play with, that I was, you know, with all the time, I didn't even know if they were in the house or not, but they were, you know, some of them were. But I didn't know, they didn't explain any of that stuff to me. You know?
Oh, so when the bombing happened, you didn't know anything. You just knew that your family, you know, was wounded, killed, and you didn't know.
I didn't know any of the details.
You didn't know that either. Oh.
I didn't know anything.
No one. They didn't tell you anything.
They didn't tell me anything.
Oh.
Nothing.
Okay. So
I saw on the news that the house was on fire.
Yeah.
When I would go to school, some of the kids that I would play with, that I was friends with, they would say, didn't they kill your family? And I would say, what are you talking about? I didn't really know what they were talking about. And so I really didn't understand what was going on. It was just, you know, it was just, I don't know, it's black and white. It's hard to read. I don't remember how it went.
Wow. So,
but most people explained it to me when I came back.
Right, yeah. So in closing, because I don't want to keep you too long, if you could talk about sort of the trauma of, or the potential trauma that one would expect you to have experienced, you know, being born to your mother in prison. And then, you know, first being raised by your grandmother or your aunt, and then your grandmother, and then being sort of seems like rescued by Ramona and taken back to your family, and then this other stuff happening that you don't understand, and then getting some clarity. But still, the whole time, you know, your family is behind bars. I mean, you go visit them, and they're captive. I mean, they're in prison. They're like 34 years, I mean, your whole lifetime.
Yeah. You know what, honestly, how do I say this? I'm supposed, at this point right now, I've never been to a psychiatrist, but just being a regular person in regular society every day, I am probably supposed to be a schizophrenic person with, like, four personalities, and I mean, probably, I don't know. You know, can't hold a job because I didn't have a stable upbringing, I guess. I don't know. I don't know what I'm supposed to be like. But what I am, I will tell you what I am.
Mm-hmm.
I've been married for 15 years.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. Wow.
Thank you.
15 years. A long time.
It is. Most marriages don't last that long. I've been married 15 years. I have four children.
Okay.
I have a house. I have a business, you know, that I run, my business.
Mm-hmm.
I have everything that you're quote-unquote supposed to have. And as far as, like, just my mother and my father, I missed out on a lot. I know I did. How much, I'll never know. But what I do know is that move people have tried really hard to compensate me for what I missed out on. And what I mean by that is I've never been without, other than you know, knowing that my mother and my father are not with me out here. I've never really been without anything I ever needed. You know, most people are not prejudiced people. They're not, they don't, you know how, you know, people say, well, that's my favorite child, you know. It seems like an innocent thing. Well, you know, I've never experienced anything like that, where people would, you know, like a certain child better than the other one, so, you know, they're going to get preferential treatment or whatever. What rules in most houses is what's right, and what somebody needs is what they get, you know. Down Africa would say, you can feed an elephant or you can feed an ant. And if you feed an elephant, it's going to seem like you're giving him a lot more than the ant. But if you're giving them both what they need, look, what it look like? You know, if the elephant is going to look like he's going to have a lot more. But if you're giving them both what they need, then he doesn't have more. He has what he needs. And that's how it is with move people, you know. They've always given me what I needed. And my parents from prison have always tried to give me as much as they could give me, too. You know, and I'm not talking about material things or birthdays or Christmas or none of that. I'm talking about giving me a level of security. And by doing that, giving me information and talking to me about what's right and what's real, so that I can understand the difference between right and wrong. And that's what makes a person secure. That's what makes a person secure. And you don't have to be physically with them to do that. Because I can tell you, there's a whole lot of people who have both their parents, their mother, their father, their aunts, uncles, grandmothers, grandfathers, and they still ain't right. You know?
That's true. That's really true. It says a lot about...
That kid did that in Colorado, shout out that movie theater.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his father was an electrical engineer. Plenty of money. Mother, he had his mother with him. You know, and what would cause a person to do something like that? You know, but, you know, that's what happened. So I'm just saying, like, you know, there's a level of security that needs to be put into children. Otherwise, whether they have their parent or not, if it's not there, they're not going to turn out right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. Yeah. I think at its core, you know, love is probably the best nurturing that one can you know, can give to a child, and that could help you work through, you know, and manage, you know, some of the most dire circumstances, you know, like having your parents away from you all of your life. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, it's been really wonderful talking to you, Mike. And I was wondering, I was just curious, what is your business? You said you're a business owner. What is your business?
I plant trees.
Oh, seriously? How lovely.
Landscaping company.
Great. We can't do it. We you know, that's wow. The trees are like little people. They're like human beings,
yeah.
And they give us air. Oh, what a great service.
Yeah.
As a business. Wow, that's great. Plant trees. That's wonderful.
Plant trees, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Is there a website that you'd like to give to our audience that is interested in finding out more about MOVE and the MOVE 9 and you know, besides this hotline number that Delbert Africa gave us, and I'll give it to our audience again, it's 717-772-4343. Other ways they can get involved, like they can also write to your parents and other members of the MOVE 9.
I can give you a phone number.
Okay.
Because the website, it changed a couple of times, and the last one that we had was taken over by pirates.
Oh my.
And it's kind of down right now. But there is a new website that they're working on.
Okay.
That I don't know the address, but I have a phone number that I can give.
Okay.
So that people can call the phone number and get the information. And they can also get all this other information, too.
Okay.
And that phone number is 215-386-1165.
Okay. So 215-386-1165 is the number people can call to get information about the MOVE organization.
About anything that has anything to do with MOVE, they can get from there.
Okay, cool. And then the website will be, it is up, but you said you just don't know the address?
There is a website going on. I don't know the exact address, no.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll find that and I'll post that as well.
Okay.
All right, cool. Well, you take good care, and when is your birthday? You said it's a month from...
September 15th.
September 15th,
okay. Right in the middle.
Right in the middle. All right. Well, you have a happy birthday, and maybe this time next year the MOVE 9 will be paroled. That would be excellent.
That would be excellent. That would be excellent.
Yeah,
and I'm sure Ramona will send out the call once it happens.
Right.
We're working on it, though.
Yeah, but in the meantime, we need to stay on the case, right?
No doubt. No doubt. Stay on the move.
All right. You take good care.
Thanks, Wanda. I appreciate it.
Okay. Peace and blessings.
All right. On the move.
On the move. See, we're going to close out this wonderful conversation with Michael Africa with the piece by Billy Harper called Knowledge of Self, and it features Amiri Baraka. On the poetry.
Fletcher's grandness, the heir to his big bandness, was the master arrived to forever lay out the blue wonderfulness of the orchestra, Duke Ellington, whose greatness transcends all trends. Duke told Max, don't let them call your music jazz, because they can make anything that. What prophecy, cold and true. Why, they can say what your boy, what's his name, Elevated G is playing is that. You did. But then, what's his name was the king of jazz. And what's the other dude was the king of swing? And we now up to in that alley, banging on them tin pans, they called it swing. But they meant a noun, not a verb. Never could get the verb in it. Remember all them ladies and men, masters and mistresses of the verbal thing? Ethel Waters in her blue, new American classical popular song, and Billy, who reached the deepest tear in our heart, and Ella, all flying off them wonderful bands who carried our hearts, our meaning in their songs. The royalty like Duke and the Count of Basie, the lady who made her alliance with the real American president, Mr. Young. And you know this one. Bean, the mighty hawk, taught us all how Lewis sounded on another horn. And the cats in their band, Duke's people at the top of the steeple, Johnny Hodges, Harry Carney, Cootie Williams, Cat Anderson, Paul Gonzales, Ben Webster, and other greats who morphed into another age. If the 20s was the jazz age, then the 30s, the Great Depression, people seemed like they got skinny. With the age of swing, from all those songs, the world was looking for love, but it seemed like there wasn't any. Goose stepping in Europe, Pain in Spain, they was painting mustaches on the Mona Lisa and putting a commode in the museum. Had civilization stopped? My man Helene said they couldn't stop bebop, and they won't stop hip-hop. Bird Blue, Dizzy New, Max carried our original earth to this place where we grew. Bud smiled, then here come Miles. There was a B and a bop. is just another beat, another bee, and another act, where the is and the unis cohabit the same frame. But the sound was a verb, not a noun, unless you could in Congo style really get down our share shake. But then the could did, and then them original hipsters appeared with the Vance and the Value of Rudy. Said you gotta have them black notes, actually they is blue. I want my fist flattened. And you gotta have the drum where we and the music come from. Dig, that word was the first I heard. It all came beyond paper. For the proper syncopation, you gotta have improvisation. We're gonna take them tired chords and make our own songs, our own stories. Otherwise, it's too dull, it don't swing, it ain't hip. We said we wanted wild, crazy, frantic. We wanted it to be exactly like us. Gone from the square world or out to lunch. My man Symphony said from the jazz corner of the world, it sounded like there was never anything before as hip as Birdland and its lullaby where I first heard the divine one, Sassy, say, you're not that kind of a boy, you're not that kind of a boy, you're not that kind of a boy for a girl like me. And we heard of Fats Navarro and Fat Girl and Kenny Clark and Coog and Long Tall Dexter Gordon and Stan Getz and Zoot Sims. We heard the hippest people in the world. But remember, when you go out, somebody gonna try to bring you back in. Bop was too hot, the anti-bop squad say. Too fast, too crazy. Crazy, we said. The counterattack was to bring it back. We all been out to lunch too long, whether it was swing or bebop, Dizzy Dream. If you wanted a cop, you had to hit the street. No road out of the jungle, that's 52nd Street, where the Charleston hit the New York docks. 12th Avenue was a shock. From Angola to the gullahs in South Carolina, got the first thing smoke, went up to New York. Charleston, James P. wrote. Greet those who landed in the devil's northern house. Hell's Kitchen, to be exact. San Juan Hill, Monk and Benny Carter's home, where Lincoln Center sits still. That's right. He on the only money that ain't white. But what we was trying to say, when it got too hot, some folks tipped away from that street. I think it was the heat. Last seen heading west, their next address. It was cool, really cool. Some said, calm down. Miles said, get down. Stan heard, Clute, Budo, Jerry heard, Lee heard, John Lewis heard, Gil Evans heard, Poncho Haygood heard. They gave birth to the school, the real birth of the cool. When the memory of the hip started to slip, the gorgeous blue, the funk we knew, they're gonna bend their knees and raise it back from the mood indigo that flows out of the black. What was bad could be bad. Much, much better than that. Thus spoke that. So when cool started to fool with my man JoJo's soul, he went out and put the church in, where the Negro's eyes be rolling back in their head and start speaking some stuff ain't never been said. A dude named Buhena played them drums like he was insane, or from the blue continent of dark under your heartbeat. Dudes named Horace drug the funky gospel into the joints, hollering, let me see what you do with your shovel. And the Holy Ghost popping his tambourine, chick-a-ching, rattle in the room. That's nasty when you bring Africa and the Lord in like that. He wanted a messenger from the Holy Ghost Mau Mau Baptist Church, and they got a message from Kenyon 125th Street. The University of Blakey, the Academy of, well, it might have seemed like that, but it really was this, where you could dig Hank Mobley and listen nobly to the man who called the uncrowned king, Kenny Dorham, but always so many others came to fill up the space with names of that school, Clifford Brown, Luke Donaldson, Chrissy Heath, Donald Byrd, Jack McLean, Lee Morgan, Benny Golson, all the way to Billy Harper and Wynton Marsalis. What all that was, and the saving of the deep historical fonts, the blues, the ancient call and response from across the trees and through the woods, so you know where I am and I wait for your response. Our blue life memory all the way back across the world. The zigzag of chance, the improv, and fix however to the mighty drum, the rhythm of life, what has no beat cannot stay. What was called hard bop was something to wake us up again to the rhythm of ourselves. Max and Brownie, along with Buhena, helped bring the fire back. The post-cool smoke fanned through the wings of the great bird, but now the heavy motion would be by train. We call that band of Miles the Hydrogen Bomb and Switchblade Band, Paul and Red, Cannonball, the Funkus, Mad Philly Joe and Train, the Monster with the Horn. Actually, Miles' great band was but a preface to another awesome being, Trains, Coy Tyner, Jimmy Garrison, Elvin Jones. But Train had to pass through the sphere of Thelonious to get deep into the mysterioso of the funk, leaving the world of the merely hip for the monkishly profound. Monk and Train at the five spot opens a new world of other than where you've been.
Let me tell you, I was there. Train didn't even know the arrangements. He sounded like a stranger. But in a minute, train was in it, and the whole building moved and pulled away. Little Rudy Tooty, jackying in Monk's moods. So around midnight, the new music came. We never was the same. By the time they got from the Bowery to Carnegie Hall, must have been time for something next stop new. Even a Pharaoh, an Ornette, an Albert, a Sun Ra fell by. They heard trains cry. Monks blew inside. A new world welcomed those with ears to hear.